to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host and the podfather of your favorite hebdomadal podcast. Oh, I'm glad you're with us. I'd suffer with cataphoria if I saw that you missed this week's show. Here's our associate producer, Kate, to tell us what's going on.
Hey, Tony. Our 2025 Nonprofit Technology Conference coverage continues with Healthier Productivity from AI. Our annual duo returns with tips and resources to make your use of artificial intelligence better for you. They also go beyond AI with many smartphone strategies, inbox management, and Miko shares his shutdown ritual for bedtime. They are Jason Shim from Canadian Center for Nonprofit Digital Resilience and Miko Marquette Whitlock, the Mindful Techie. On Tony's Take Two.
Tales from the Gym. The Brooklyn Bridge Crash Cacophony.
Here is Healthier Productivity from AI.
It's a pleasure to welcome back from 25 NTC our perennials, the perennial team, Jason Shim and Miko Marquette Whitlock. Jason is Chief Digital Officer at Canadian Center for Nonprofit Digital Resilience. Miko Marquette Whitlock is the Workplace Wellbeing Strategist at Mindful Techie LLC. I just consider Miko the Mindful Techie. I'm sure you do well-being strategist, workplace well-being strategist. Maybe that has SEO value. I don't know, but I just think of you as the Mindful Techie, period. That's all.
I receive it.
Is that okay? Good.
That's okay. Happy to be here.
All right. We couldn't meet in person at NTC this year because your session is virtual. So we're catching up after the conference. And your topic is AI, apps, tools, and tactics for healthier productivity. You know, like I said, the perennial team, we may as well just do our usual tennis match, you know, back and forth.
Let's do it.
If we start with Miko, I think it's only fair that we then end with Jason. So we have, not that I want to cut us short or anything, but just looking ahead, you know, we'll do lots of rounds back and forth, and we'll start with Miko and end somewhere with Jason. Okay?
Excellent.
You guys know what's up. You've got some browser tools, you've got some phone tips and strategies. Let's start with the phone. It's so damn ubiquitous. You know, there's more press now, I think, about the harm that and isolation that our ubiquitous handheld devices are causing us. So Miko, it feels appropriate to start with the Mindful Techie.
Absolutely.
With phone. And maybe, can you give us a little motivation just in case we believe our phone is 100% value and 0% risk or, isolation creating or other maladjusting the problems that it causes for us in case we don't realize the downside of our
absolutely So technology is a beautiful thing, including our phones. They've allowed us to live at this point in time where we're able to essentially connect and collaborate and live and work pretty much anywhere, anytime, any device. And so there are some wonderful things that can come with that, but if we overdo it and we're not aware of sort of the incentives that are created by app developers and folks that are creating phones to capture and to keep our attention, if we're not aware of those things, it can move to the other side of the scale where it can have a negative impact, right? Where we are perhaps impacted by the quality of our sleep or our relationships because we're spending so much time on our devices. We're comparing ourselves to these idealized images and stories that we see on social media, and the list goes on and on and on. So for folks that might be finding themselves in a situation where maybe your sleep is disrupted, or maybe your work is not as effective as it could be, or maybe you're having FOMO and you're having a hard time disconnecting, I want to share just a few things. I'm going to share three quick things for any mobile device, whether it's Mac or the iOS or Apple devices, or whether it's an Android device. The first is a tip that is about enabling what's known as the grayscale mode on your phone. So for folks that have vision challenges, some folks might recognize this feature as an accessibility feature, but it can be used outside of that context. And the intention for this is to recognize that when we think about the colors of the screen, the screen palette, how the particular icons are developed and the actual design, the actual colors, they're intentionally designed to be irresistible. They're intentionally designed to be enticing, to capture and to hold your attention. And enabling grayscale mode essentially turns your phone to a version of black and white. And it makes, from a psychological perspective, it makes your phone actually less interesting as a toy. And it really forces you to slow down and to be a bit more intentional when you're actually picking up your device, right? Because it doesn't have that same sort of dopamine hit when you have the color version enabled. So that's the first one, enabling what's called the grayscale mode. You can go into your accessibility settings on either the Android phone or on your Apple phone, and you can find the settings to be able to adjust that. The second, moving on from the grayscale mode, the second is about do not disturb. So do not disturb is a feature that I think many of us know about. It's something that has evolved over the years. And one of the beautiful evolutions that we've seen is that it used to be that you had to manually enable do not disturb in order to sort of quiet, pause, or turn off notifications for a certain period of time. Now you can actually schedule that, right? You can set a schedule for yourself to enable or to disable rather your notifications so that you're able to focus at a particular point in time. And you're able to do this based on time. And you're also, in some cases, able to do it automatically based on geography. So in my case, I have my Do Not Disturb automatically enabled for the evening through the morning. So around 9 p.m., my Do Not Disturb enables automatically. That's, for me, an indication to begin my shutdown ritual for bedtime. And in the morning, it doesn't shut off until 10 a.m. And part of that is because I want to be able to start my day and get some things done without being interrupted by the pings and the dings and all the wonderful things that our devices allow us to engage with. So if that's a challenge for you in terms of sleep, distractions, maybe you're the kind of person where you have a particular schedule where maybe when you're in a particular office location, you want your notifications to be shut off automatically. Those are some instances where that might be helpful for you. The final one I want to share is a feature that's called Raise to Wake. And there's an equivalent feature that's called something slightly different, but it does the same thing on the Android device. But this exists for both Apple and Android. So many of us aren't necessarily aware of this, that when you touch your phone, you tap it or you pick it up, for many of our devices, the default is set so that the screen automatically lights up, right? So if you have a passcode, you're able to enter the passcode. If there's no passcode, the screen lights up and it shows you the last thing that you were looking at on your phone. Well, you can actually disable that. And what that allows you to do, it essentially turns your phone into an equivalent of like a, I'm going to call it a brick, for example. And what that means is for many of us, we unconsciously pick up our phones even when there isn't a notification, because we've been trained, you know, we think of Pavlov from psychology, for example, where there's this stimulus. And so we're sort of used to picking up our phone, even when there isn't a stimulus, we are picking it up and expecting something to be there.
Or we're just picking it up to put it in our pocket to go to the next room.
Exactly. And so what this allows you to do is to disable that feature where the screen lights up automatically, and it forces you to actually press a button or in some other way manually engage with your phone before the screen actually lights up. So it creates an extra step for you to actually be able to use your phone. And again, that extra step can create a pause that allows you to slow down and to really begin to ask yourself, okay, well, what's really my intention in this moment? Do I really need to be engaged with my phone, or what is it that I need to do in this particular moment? So if you're looking to make your phone less addicting, three options here, enabling grayscale mode, scheduling, do not disturb, or automating do not disturb, and then disabling the raise to wake feature.
Okay. I just want to hit on where you find those. You already told us enabling grayscale is in settings, accessibility, yes. Right? Yes. How about the do not disturb scheduling? That's in the command center on iPhone, right? You just pull down from the upper right corner. Is it command center or control center?
Yes, so you can access it through your control center. And then if you go actually into your settings, I'm not sure which menu it is, but you can find it there. The beautiful thing with the newer, because there are so many, the settings have evolved, you can now just sort of search for what you're looking for. So if you open your settings and you type in do not disturb, okay, it'll take you to where you need to go to adjust those settings.
And iPhone, I think, now calls this focus. Isn't that?
They move it around with every update.
It's under focus, because that includes driving.
Yeah.
Plus everything you described, you know, it might absolutely be a certain location or a certain time. Okay. Okay.
Yes. Focus
and do not disturb within focus. And then raise to wake to disable.
I believe raise to wake is another accessibility feature. I take that back. It's a display and brightness setting. So if you look at your display and brightness setting on the in the iOS ecosystem, you'll be able to find that feature for the raise to wake.
Okay. And for Android, we don't know where that is. Anybody, either of you have an Android phone? I do not. So
I do not either, but from what I understand, it's pretty easy to either search for.
Okay. Oh, you search for it. Well, you just said, raise to wake. Just search for raise to wake on Android. Okay. Okay. All right. Very good. I use the focus when I'm writing, and I still do it manually. And bedtime, before bed, I certainly don't want notifications or texts or anything to come through. And to your point about how it's designed to keep us, the one that I find most annoying is the three dots and the texting. When the person when the person is typing a reply to your text, it's just so shamefully designed to keep you there. Don't leave the app.
It's like to be continued.
To be continued. Your friend is texting. You don't want to miss your friend's reply, as if you're going to, as if it's possible to miss a text. But just wait right here. Just stare at those three dots. They'll be done very, very shortly. That one I find the most annoying. Sometimes I put it down just to frustrate the Apple purpose to have me keep the
app. Can I add one thing to that?
Absolutely.
So I don't know if you can turn off the three dots, but one thing that you can do to sort of lower the anxiety around sort of the rapid expectations for texting is to turn off the read receipts, right? So that, you know, maybe you read something, but you need time, or you're not able to respond right away. And the other person is making up a story about why you didn't respond or why you didn't respond quick enough. If you turn off the read receipts, you can sort of, you could do away with some of that.
Right. Some of the anxiety. Because then your message will just say delivered.
Exactly.
Show when it was read or whether it was read.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do we need to know? I mean, do I need to know to the hour and minute, you know, when the message was read? Probably not. That's a good one. I haven't done that, but. Okay, very good. Very good. Jason, the ball's over on your side of the court. I don't know if we're playing ping pong or tennis or whatever, but what do you have for us for apps, tools, and tactics for healthy productivity this year? Healthier. I love that healthier is part of the session title.
Yeah, so related to some of the messaging efforts, flagging for folks that may not be aware that there are desktop messaging tools that can tie into some of the messaging tools that are used on the phone. So, you know, if you're using, WhatsApp or Signal, you know, just a heads up that there are also desktop tools that allow you to send out those messages directly on your laptop rather than having to switch back and forth constantly. And if you're on Android, there's also an app called Mighty Text, which allows you to send and receive text messages directly from your desktop. And of course, the classic iMessage, which helps bridge between iPhones and the laptop as well. And another thing that's neat about WhatsApp.
What was the name of that app? You said it quickly. The name of the app.
Oh yes, it's Mighty Text, and that's for Android users.
Yep. Mighty Text for Android. Thank you. Okay.
And to go back to WhatsApp, there's actually two versions of WhatsApp that I want to make sure folks are aware of. There's WhatsApp, and then there's WhatsApp Business. And so WhatsApp Business has a few extra features. One of them is that it allows you to also work with multiple phone numbers as well. So, you know, if you are working with multiple numbers, a personal and a professional one as well, WhatsApp Business helps bridge that gap.
Okay.
Yeah. And
Go ahead, do another one. Miko took liberties with knocking off three and one. So
I'll shift gears a bit. You know, just highlighting a few of the generative AI tools that are out there. And so, you know, the big one that is out there that a lot of folks have heard of are certainly, you know, ChatGPT. As well on the Google side, there's Gemini. On the Microsoft side, there's Copilot. And there's another tool called Cloud, which is made by an organization called Anthropic. And, you know, just to remind folks that, you know, if you're not necessarily paying to use the platforms, that you have to be very conscious of whether what you're putting into some of these generative AI tools is being used for their training data sets. So that's just something to double check to make sure for the platforms that you're using that what the security and privacy settings are set to. And with that in mind, so I just want to share, you know, a few of the others that are out there in terms of the generative AI models is with regards to having a good prompt to make sure you're getting good results. You know, I often hear folks that may not be satisfied with some of the results, and an easy way to try and get better results is to try and tell the model what you want it to be or what you are looking for. So rather than just telling it, you know, I want this done, sometimes the preface leading off the prompt by saying, say, you are an expert at X. So, you know, if you were looking to perhaps review some text or something, that is like, you are an expert copy editing bot. And then you can continue with the rest of the request that you would like. If you're looking for something more comprehensive, there's something that you can do that I call meta prompting. And so that is actually asking the model to come up with a comprehensive prompt for you. So it's a little kind of pre-conversation. So what that might look like is you are an AI expert and an expert in X. Help me craft a comprehensive prompt to do Y. And so what that may look like is you are an AI expert and an expert in copy editing. Help me craft a comprehensive prompt to review this body of text in extreme detail and highlight all the changes that may be needed. And so that gets you a much, much more comprehensive response. Some of the emerging models are they do go into a bit more detail, even if you give it a basic prompt, but the more explicit that you can be in terms of telling it what it is that you want it to do in that regard, and the kind of model that you, or the kind of role that you want to play, helps you get a much more focused and directed response.
That's very interesting. So you have to, or you don't have to, but it's valuable to tell the AI bot that you are an AI expert. To me, that's like one of your colleagues coming to you and saying, all right, Jason, you're the chief digital officer here. You have to remind it of what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't have to, but it helps. It helps to remind it of what it is.
Totally. You're kind of pumping it up a little bit and, you know, allowing it to remember. It's like, hey, you know, you're supposed to be, you know, an expert in the thing. And the reason why that works is because the way that large language models work is that it's associating the proximity of certain words with one another. And so at the outset, if you are telling it, it's like, you're an expert. And from there, it's starting off with that core of you're an expert in that area, that entire cluster of knowledge and sentiment is going to be closer to it. So you're going to get more expertise focused language that will be coming back to you.
And I have an analogy that might be helpful for understanding what you just shared, Jason, which is that if you think of these generative AI tools as maybe like an intern, you could hire sort of an intern that has sort of some general knowledge to support you. Or you could say, actually, I need a marketing intern. I need someone that has some marketing skills and some marketing know-how. Or I need an intern that's really good at fundraising or that has some experience with fundraising. Or I need an intern that is really good with volunteer management. And so by asking the prompt that Jason was sharing around, you're an expert in, you're simply saying, I'm looking to hire an intern and here's the type of experience that I'm looking for.
Okay, excellent. All right.
Yeah.
It pays to give the thing some credibility. Remind it of its value. You're an expert in AI, and then you're an expert in or whatever level you want to be talking at with the subject matter. Okay. Miko, why don't you go ahead? Come on. It's your turn.
All right. So if we're sticking with AI, I wanted to maybe provide people two very practical ways that you could address some common pain points. And one is using Google Gemini. I've used Google Workspace. So Google Gemini is the generative AI tool for Google and for Gmail. And so one of the pain points that I have is when I sign up for events, if there isn't an automatic iCal tool that adds it to my calendar, I have to manually add the event to my calendar. And it takes a lot of time, it's very distracting, and it takes me off task. Well, you can actually ask Gemini to do that for you. You could say, hey, Gemini, add the event in this email to my calendar and copy the contents of this email into the calendar description. What would take me maybe 5-10 minutes to do takes Gemini less than 30 seconds to do, right? And so it's a huge time saver and it reduces stress and anxiety level with those tedious tasks that can build up for many of us.
Another example.
Oh, go ahead.
Let me pull this a little deeper.
Yes.
I don't understand. How is Gemini getting control over your calendar app? I mean, I'm accustomed to AI. You give specific prompts and you get something back, either written or visual, or you know, it could be music, yes, or video. But I don't talk about my usages.
Yes.
So I don't understand how it's getting use of your system.
Absolutely. So Google Gemini is Google's tool of choice. Google's AI, generative AI platform. They've integrated it into all of the Google tools. And so I use Google Gmail, for example, for my email. And so Google Gemini's AI tool is integrated into that. It's akin to the way that Siri is integrated with iOS, right? So you could ask Siri, you know, what's the weather like, or what's the next appointment on my calendar? It's a similar type of integration.
Okay, I see. All right. Go ahead.
So I was going to share another example with generative AI to share again about lowering stress levels and anxiety and the amount of time that we're spending on some of these tedious tasks. One of the things I've found that generative AI tools, particularly tools like ChatGPT, for example, are really good at providing sort of baseline summary and analysis of unstructured data. So let's take survey feedback. In my case, I do a lot of trainings. and I conduct pre and post survey evaluations. Depending on the volume of responses, that can take some time to go sift through and to find sort of the meaningful insights from that. Well, the tools have evolved to such a point that you could literally download the CSV file or the Excel file of all of your qualitative data. You could upload this into a tool like ChatGPT, and you could ask it to generate, for example, a one-page summary of key highlights and give me some direct quotes from participants in this particular training. Identify the top three things that I should focus on if I were to do this training again. Very, very super helpful. What I can do manually that would take me a while, right? ChatGPT can do pretty much in a matter of minutes. Now, the caveat here is, to Jason's point about the data that you're putting into these systems, you want to be mindful of not adding sensitive data. So in my case, I'm using anonymized data. I'm using data that is pretty low stakes in terms of privacy in my case. And I'm also aware that there might be gaps or there might be things that the tools are missing. So I'm using it to supplement my analysis, not to replace it. And I'm using it to get sort of baseline insights. It's not the same as if I were using it to just say, upload, let's say, clinical data from a hospital and asking ChatGPT to make recommendations about medical decisions, right? That would not be an appropriate use of one of these tools. So it matters in this particular use case, the type of data that you're using and what type of decisions you're going to be making based on what ChatGPT gives you. You want to be very mindful of those things.
It's time for Tony's Take Two.
Thank you, Kate. I've got a new tale from the gym. After the Mexican Navy ship crashed into the Brooklyn Bridge, that was a weekend. Then the next day in the gym, you should have heard the grand pontificators. These guys, a couple guys who own, through the gym times, you know, I've heard them talk about their boats. Like they have like these, you know, fishing boats, like 20 or 30 foot little fishing pleasure craft that they have. And to hear them speculating like they were master captains of, you know, 1,000 foot vessels, like Royal Caribbean sails, and listening to them, where was the captain and the pilot? The pilot is somebody who's familiar with the local waters. They go on a ship because they know the local navigation and where the channels are and things. That much I know. So where were the pilot and the captains? Didn't they know that the current is very bad in that part of the New York Harbor? Why didn't they throw down the anchor? So I was just listening to these guys. Like, this is a three-masted ship with, I think it's 300 feet. They were 300 feet long. There's something like 280 people on board. Two people died, you know, at three masts. And like all these, the closest thing these guys have to is a fishing pole. That's like their mast. They hold their fishing pole up. So, you know, they were just way out of their league. And I thought it was very funny listening to these masters of naval navigation speculate about why the Mexican naval ship should not have crashed. So there's another tale from the gym, and there's another Tony's Take Two. Kate?
Every time there's a catastrophe, I feel like random people think that they are just masters of whatever. That reminds me of like the Titanic, where it's like, oh, if I was the captain, I would be able to like not hit the iceberg, because people just think that they're like experts on everything and that they could do no wrong. It's so funny to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is, you know, days after the crisis too.
Right.
You know, you're in the heat of a crisis, the ship is drifting, you don't know what's going on. And, you know, but these guys, these master 20-foot boat owners, you know, they know exactly what to do with the 300-foot naval ship. Right. Okay, yeah. Thank you. If I wasn't a baby boomer, I would say, okay, boomer.
We've got buku buttloads more time. Here's the rest of Healthier Productivity from AI with Jason Shim and Miko Marquette Whitlock.
That's an important caveat, because unless you're using a proprietary large language model or generative tool, whatever you give it is going to be added to its large language training.
Absolutely. And Jason talked about earlier where there's an option to, with all of these models, to turn off the setting that feeds data into the models for training. But in addition to that, you know, I don't know if we want to switch gears here, but Jason can probably walk through some of the tools that are available for folks that maybe you don't want your data to be fed into a public version of ChatGPT, for example. There are alternatives to that that would be more secure depending on what you're trying to use the tools for. So I don't know if we want to switch over to Jason. He can maybe talk about some of those.
Yeah, we're on the AI topic, and that's a perfect segue. Thanks, Miko.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to share, there's a program that's called Olama. And what it does is it requires a little bit of a heavier technical lift, but if you're willing to go through the documentation and to install it, what it does is that it allows you to pull in open source AI models directly into your computer so that after you get it all set up, you could actually disconnect your computer from the internet and use a local AI model so it doesn't have to leave your computer, and you know it doesn't have to touch the internet. So if you are examining data that's a little bit more sensitive, or you would like a peace of mind that it's a little bit more protected, Olama is the program that you are looking for, and it is available for Mac, for Windows, as well as Linux. And you do need a bit of a heftier computer or hardware in order to run it. So, you know, if you have a more of a late model machine, you're better positioned to make use of it. But it does exist out there to allow you to have a bit more privacy with regards to keeping it contained within your machine.
Okay, that's excellent, because I had just mentioned, you know, unless you are operating with a proprietary model that I was envisioning some consultant had created for you, but you can do it on your own. You said it requires some time up front, or it requires a degree of expertise aside from the hardware. Does it require some expertise in programming or anything like that, or you just have a lot of selections to make, or what's the upfront look like?
Yeah, you don't necessarily have to be a developer to use it. However, if you have some familiarity with using a command line interface or like the terminal window in Mac or Windows, that is needed in order to get some of the models set up and running. There are guides that are out there. So, you know, if you're able to follow through carefully step by step to go through it, like it is possible to get it up and running. Olama, O-L-L-A-M-A is the tool that makes that possible.
Okay. There's probably instructional videos on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. All right. It's doable.
And along those lines, for folks who are looking for additional tools that to keep things self-contained, there's a tool called Mac Whisper, as you can tell by the name, it's limited to the Mac. I have been trying to search for like a Windows equivalent, but Mac Whisper is helpful in that if you're working with a lot of audio. And I know that some of the online tools, they may have limitations in terms of minutes or the amount that you can process in terms of transcriptions. That Mac Whisper sits on your computer, and it makes use of open source transcription models, which many of the online tools are also using as well. And you know, if you have you know, a handful of files, or if you have hundreds of files or thousands of hours, that you can batch transcribe huge amounts of audio, depending on your use case. And you can also configure it for various settings, like if you would like it to have the timestamps, say if you are looking to export those for captioning like a YouTube video or something. So if you're working with both large or small, you know, amounts of audio, MacWhisper may also be a good tool. The other use case for MacWhisper is that if you are using a tool, a meeting tool that doesn't necessarily have a built-in transcription feature, that you can also have a setting to record the audio from an app to help with that afterwards. So you don't necessarily have to have it built into an app you're using, that it can capture you know, whatever you're hearing on your headphones to also capture to transcribe for your own use case.
That's interesting, because then you could be recording and you're unless you reveal that to folks, they aren't going to know that the session, the meeting is being recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's operating external from Zoom or whatever video app you might be using.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's important to make sure that that is disclosed, and if it is being used according to, you know, local legislation that may be relevant to where folks are living as well.
Yeah, or just basic ethics.
Yes.
Yeah. I'll go a step further, and I think two things. So one, you should always assume that anything is recorded, period. It's similar to assuming that the mute button is broken, right? Just assume, I don't care if it says you're muted, just assume that it's not working. Because things do happen, and you just don't know. And then the third thing is just be a good person. Right. And you won't have to worry about some of these things. Right. So be a good person, you know, be ethical, and you won't have to worry about whether something is recorded or not in some of these scenarios.
Yeah. Keep it clean.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Miko, before we go back to you for whatever you may have next, I wanted to ask you if you would explain manage my inbox, because We've talked about that before. I believe is that the app that you use for your inbox management? Is it called Manage My Inbox, or is it something else?
It's called, I believe you're referring to Inbox When Ready.
Inbox When Ready.
Yes. Okay. Inbox When Ready. It's a tool that is something that I use in combination with Gmail, which is the email provider that I primarily rely on. And it is a tool that allows me to do a few things. One of the primary things that allows me to do is, for most of us, when we open our inbox, we see a litany of unread emails begging for our attention, right? And so what Inbox When Ready allows you to do is to install a plugin that essentially hides the main inbox, and it allows you to navigate to other parts of your inbox. So let's just say I was looking for the information for joining this call today, Tony, and that was the only thing that I was in my inbox for. Using Inbox When Ready allows me to be more likely to focus on that and to actually do that, as opposed to logging in and saying, oh my God, I just got a new email from Jason. Oh my God, I want a trip to Hawaii. And now I'm trying to book my trip to Hawaii, and I've forgotten that I was actually looking to find the email from Tony, right? The second thing that it does is, it, in terms of raising your level of awareness of how much time you're spending in your inbox, it allows you to actually see stats on how much time you spent in your inbox. And for some people, psychologically, if you see, oh my God, I spent 5 hours checking email today. For many of us, if we're aware of that, we're like, oh wow, I should be more conscientious about how much time I'm spending in my inbox, because I actually could have gotten these things done had I not wasted 5 hours just sifting through emails. And so I use this particular plugin for Gmail, and it's super helpful for those reasons.
Okay, that's Inbox When Ready.
Yes.
All right, thank you. Go ahead. It's still your turn.
Awesome.
Whatever's on the list.
So, sort of along this vein of inbox and ready, let's switch and talk a little bit about browser tools to really protect your focus. I'm going to share two of my favorites. The first is a browser plugin called Stay Focus. It's a tool that is compatible with Chrome and Brave if you're using it on the desktop. And it works by helping you to restrict the amount of time you spend on time-wasting websites. So you identify your time-wasting website. So for me, that might be political news, or that might be Reddit, for example. And it gives you a daily time budget for each of those. So in my case, my daily time-wasting budget is 30 minutes. So I get 30 minutes to be on any of those websites. And if I'm on one of those websites after my 30 minutes expires, I get a pop-up that says, shouldn't you be working? And my access is blocked to those websites until it resets in the next 24-hour period. So it's a really good way, I think, to really balance allowing yourself to indulge a little bit, but not go too far where you're wasting all of your time that you could be focusing on other things.
That's interesting. I assume you can set the budget, right? You
choose. Yeah, you can set the budget, yes.
How much time you want to squander per day. That's a hard one to choose. You would want to say zero, but it's not squandering. It's fun time. Call it pleasure time or something like that. Okay.
Absolutely. And the truth is that psychologically, using Pareto's, there's a principle called Pareto's principle, or some of us know as the 80-20 rule. Psychologically, we know that we're more likely to be consistent with something if we have an opportunity to indulge every once in a while, right? So when we think about fitness and exercise, yes, it might be great to eat whole foods and exercise every day 100% of the time. Most people aren't able to do that, right? But if you say, okay, well, if you just did it 80% of the time, more people are going to be more likely to stick with it over the long term. So this is a similar principle that we're applying here in terms of the distracting websites.
Awesome. When the pop-up comes up, do you have a chance to extend your time, or is it's draconian? It says, no, you got to get out.
So you can disable you can uninstall the plugin there. You can use another web browser.
No. Okay. But just the pop-ups, when the pop-ups come up after your, whatever your allotted time, does it let you out? Does it give you an escape hatch? You can have another 10 minutes
if you are insistent, there are ways around it, but the intention is that you set this up willingly, like you've opted in. So
yes,
you would sort of adhere to the budget that you set for yourself.
It should be abiding by your own boundaries.
Exactly.
I mean, how can you expect other people to abide by your boundaries if you don't even abide by them yourself? Right?
Yes.
All right. I mean, how undisciplined can you be? You the thing asked you how many minutes you want, and you allocated them, and then you're not even going to keep to that? I mean, so how? you're a lackluster performer. No. All right. Go ahead, Jason, please.
Yeah. So what comes to mind is there's something called MindMac. And so this is another tool that it helps you deal with the subscription fatigue for AI tools. So, as you are signing up for the various AI tools, that you may observe that, you're paying multiple subscriptions depending on how you may be using it. However, the different tools are good for different things. And a way to deal with that is by using a program like MindMac. What it allows you to do is that you can go to each of the individual services, so like ChatGPT or Gemini or Perplexity or Cloud, and sign up as a developer with an API key or application programming interface key. And what you can do is that you can take those keys and then put it in MindMac. And so the analogy I would provide is you may not need to buy an entire package of raisins, that you actually just want a scoop, just for what you're baking. And this is the digital equivalent of that. You may not need the full $20 a month subscription to some of the services, that if you're only going to be using a few cents a month of a certain service, that this is a way to directly pay for what you use across the different models. So MindMac can be super helpful if you're using multiple models, say if you're looking for to spread some of the requests, or to even use multiple models to compare the responses, that you don't have to necessarily get a full subscription for all of them. But you are subscribed in a different way for using the API key and only consuming what you need. And so this may make the difference between having to pay somewhere upwards of $80 or $100 a month across like 4 or 5 different services, and really only paying like $5 or $6 for the handful of requests that you may make. And you know, it's not mutually exclusive. Like, you know, I've seen that some folks may opt to subscribe to one model, but still want to be able to access the others. And so when you're using MindMap, you can just select a dropdown and, you know, select which service you would like to use, and you can change it up as you see necessary to compare the results.
Are either of you mindful of the energy consumption that goes into generative AI responses to prompts? I've just been reading about this recently, that they consume a lot of energy to answer even basic questions, because they're sifting through so much data. Are either of you conscious of that, or mindful, or are you aware of this?
I think at a macro level, I'm aware. I mean, I understand sort of the quote unquote arms race that's happening to acquire land and water resources and electricity in order to build these massive data centers to make this possible. And I know that, you know, the big ones like the Amazons, the Googles, Microsoft, et cetera, they're competing fiercely all over the world. They're scavenging every corner of the earth to find places to put these data centers, and to find electricity and to find water to be able to meet the needs of sort of what's required for this. On a micro level, it's a bit more challenging, right? Because you have a need, you have a pain point in a moment. And so you aren't necessarily thinking about, oh, this is going to use this many kilowatts, I shouldn't ask this question. It's more like, I have this pain point, I need this thing right now, and so I'm going to press enter and see what it can do for me. And I think that's probably where a lot of folks are. And I think there's probably a lot more education that can happen for all of us in terms of just being a bit more mindful of what you just raised.
Okay. I mean, the response would be each micro accumulated creates the macro. Right? Each of our individual demands in the forms of prompts creates the need for the macro problem that you described. I'm not saying I don't use it. I'm not saying I beat myself up, but it's something that came to my awareness recently. And I wasn't, I guess I did know about the macro too, but I was thinking more of the each individual prompt. I don't know. Jason, how do you feel about this?
Yeah, I think it certainly touches upon the broader considerations about like the energy mixes in different areas. So, you know, depending on where you live or where the data centers are located, you know, some areas may have, you know, heavier kind of carbon consumption with regards to, you know, generation of electricity, as opposed to other areas that may have more renewable sources like hydroelectric or solar power as well. So, you know, I think that certainly underscores the need to be aware of and perhaps advocate for, you know, as part of the macro, you know, more sustainable energy sources to power these things. Because I think that if we are looking at from a simple kind of thought experiment, like, are we going to see more or less usage of AI and or energy consumption? Like right now, it's trending towards more, though there are, you know, developments that are looking at, you know, how to make, you know, the processing of these AI models more efficient and effective over time. But I think this does underscore, you know, the broader, you know, broader considerations around energy policy and that approach that, you know, to the extent that, you know, we can also ask the questions of the providers, you know, to also, you know, make them aware that, you know, this is something that as users of, of these services that we'd like to hear from them on, in terms of like, hey, you know, how are you approaching, you know, your energy consumption, you know, what's in your roadmap, and things like that.
I don't know. Go ahead, Mika.
No, I was gonna say, so I think one interesting thing about this is that there is an incentive for companies to make their models more efficient, precisely for this reason, because it costs them money to be able to, you know, build the data centers, pay for the electricity and so on. And so that's something that we're seeing. There's competition to make models a bit more efficient. One thing that I wanted
to add, a few weeks ago or a month ago or something, we had that Chinese model.
Exactly.
That said, yeah, they could use, I don't know, a tiny, tiny proportion of the time and portion of the time and energy required from the US models.
So that's one example. One thing I wanted to add to this, so we were talking about natural resources. I wanted to add to the mix also human resources. So one of the things that's often not talked about is how many people die in order to build these data centers, right? So in terms of physical labor to actually build them, right? And the dangers and the accidents that happen along the way, but then also the fact that there's an arms race between these different companies where they make low-level labor sort of expendable, right? Because they're trying to build as quickly as possible. It's not something that we talk about, but if you do a search, you'll see fill in the blank big company, you know, data center explosions, or you'll see articles about sort of deaths of laborers and workers who are working in the data centers, people who burn out, for example, and a whole host of things that we're not considering when we think about just the human toll beyond the natural resources.
Excellent. Thank you. Not something I was aware of, the labor exploitation, basically, and treat labor as a commodity. Interesting. To end on a little higher note, but still, I mean, these things are, you know, these somber topics are important too. I'm not minimizing them. I brought them up. So, Mika, how much of your shutdown ritual for bedtime are you willing to share?
Yeah. So you want just the tech piece, or you want like just overall, like what?
No, overall. You're okay. A holistic person. You're a mindful thinker, the mindful techie. The as much of the ritual as you're willing to share.
Absolutely.
No intimate details, please. But what's your bedtime ritual? When does it start, and go from there?
So I have a bedtime timer that goes off about 9 o'clock, around the same time that my alerts enable. That gives me 30 minutes to wrap up whatever I'm doing. So if I'm watching something on YouTube or Netflix, I have another 30 minutes to sort of wrap that up. And then it moves into what I call JOMO, or joy of missing out, which is wherever I am, whatever's happening, however engaging, whatever it is that I'm doing, it's time to release that and to get ready for bed. And so I have a ritual where I do some stretching. I do a quick 5 minute, exercise routine, light cardio, and I take some time to sit and to reflect. I might do a little bit of light reading, particularly fiction, in the evening. And then one of the final things I do is I take some time to really consider, you know, what I'm grateful for, what I'm releasing, what I'm allowing myself to receive into my life. And I set an intention to rest well and to rise well for the next day.
That's beautiful. That's so admirable. All right. There's a reason you're the mindful techie. That's him, Mika Marquette-Whitlock. You'll find him at Mindful Techie. Well, his company is Mindful Techie LLC. Is it mindfultechie.com?
Yes, mindfultechie.com.
Aptly named. And Jason Shim, Chief Digital Officer at Canadian Center for Nonprofit Digital Resilience. Our perennial pair. I'm sure we'll be back in 2026 with more apps, tips, tactics, etc. Thanks very much. Mika, Jason, thanks so much for sharing.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure.
Next week, we go on hiatus from 25 NTC with Storytelling and Local Media, featuring Fabiana Melendez Ruiz. If you missed any part of this week's show,
I beseech you, find it at tonymartinetti.com.
Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. I'm your associate producer, Kate Martinetti. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. Mark Silverman is our web guy, and this music is by Scott Stein.
Thank you for that affirmation, Scotty. Be with us next week for Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great!